Well, I, Brother McGovern, Pastor McGovern, asked me in November, I think it was, if I would come here and preach a revival. And I'll admit to you, I've never preached a revival series before. And the reason why is because I'm in Korea. I'm a missionary. We just do our thing, you know. That's what we do. So I prayed about it, and I thought that the Lord had, I really believe that the Lord has led me to do a series of messages out of the Song of Solomon. And immediately when you hear that, you go, oh man, how is he going to do that? It's good. It really is good. It's a good book. So if you will, turn to the book of Song of Solomon. I'll give you just a few minutes to find that. Most people don't read that book. They just kind of pass right through there quickly. But turn there. I would like us to stand. In my church, we stand and we read the scriptures together. Then I pray and then we sit. So that's kind of what I'm used to doing. I've done that for so many years that I would feel like I need to do that in order for it to get off on the right foot. But we're only going to read one verse. We'll read it together. Song of Solomon, chapter 1, verse 1. And I still see some people turning. And so we'll just wait for just a few minutes. In my church, we're a military church, and people come and go. In fact, I get a brand new congregation every year, and I'm not kidding you. Every year, a whole new group of people. And they come in from all kinds of different churches in the States, carrying all kinds of different translations in the States. And so in order to get us all on the right page, I started doing this. And so now I'm used to doing this, and I have to do this because that's what I do. So, Song of Solomon, chapter 1, verse 1. Let's read that together, then I'll pray, and then we'll be seated. The Song of Songs, which is Solomon's. See, that wasn't so bad, was it? Let's pray. Lord, thank you for your word. Thank you for the opportunity to look into it, to see what you have for us this morning. I pray that you bless this week. Bless every message. As you've directed, help me, Lord, to deliver it. Help your people to listen, Lord, with their hearts open and ready to receive. We commit this to you in Jesus' name. Amen. You may be seated. Like I said, I want to bring a series of messages from the Song of Solomon. And if there's a theme for the week, it would be simply, how's your love life? I'm going to ask you that question, I don't know how many times, throughout the course of this revival meeting. How's your love life? I'm not talking about your love life with your wife or your husband. That should be good. I hope it's good. But how's your love life with the Lord? Now, as I examine preaching, I find that there's really about three different approaches that a preacher can take to a message. He can take an evangelistic approach. I like to call it the courtroom approach, where the preacher turns the room into a courtroom, and he preaches the law of God and brings everybody under condemnation for their sin. And then after that, he explains how Jesus is the payment for the sin and challenges people to accept that payment. I like to call that the evangelistic or the courtroom approach. Another approach that you can take, I like to call it the educational approach or the classroom approach, where the preacher will take some doctrine or passage of the scripture and literally take it apart and reassemble it and teach it and show how it all fits together. And at the end, the idea is so that the student, which would be, of course, everyone else, would listen to that and figure out how it all goes together and figure out how they can actually use this in their life. And then, thankfully, hopefully, they'll actually go out and do that. A third approach, which I think is more along the lines of this message, is what I like to call the devotional approach, where you turn the room in kind of a lover's lane and you lift up the Lord Jesus Christ and you exalt him for his greatness and his beauty. And as you begin to preach in that style, then everyone gets a glimpse of who Christ is and his glory, and they fall in love with him all over again. That's what I think this week is going to be for us. I want you to see Christ in this book and see the love that he has for you, and hopefully challenge you to have a deeper love for him. Now, there are in the Old Testament five books that we call the poetic books. The first book, does anybody know? The book of Job, okay? Each of these five books holds a secret kind of a theme or a key, a secret that we learn from it. And in the book of Job, we get the secret to suffering. I remind you, it's in the book of Job where Job says this. He says this about God. He says, though he slay me, yet will I trust in him. Now that's faith. No matter what God does, no matter how bad it gets, I'm going to trust him. I'm going to trust him. Then you move from the book of Job and you get into the very next book, the book of Psalms. And it's in the book of Psalms where we learn the secret to worship. One of my favorite verses in the Psalms has to deal with worship. It's in Psalm 95 or Psalm 96, somewhere around there, where he begins to speak of worship. And he says, I will worship. It's a 138. I will worship toward thy holy temple and will praise thy name for thy loving kindness and thy truth. And we learn the secret of worship in the book of Psalms. And then you go from Psalms to Job to Psalms. And then the next book you come to is the book of Proverbs. The book of Proverbs holds the secret to wisdom. And it's written in Proverbs several times where you can find statements about wisdom. The book is filled with wisdom. You have a couple of chapters where wisdom is personified and speaks to us. But a good example would be in Proverbs chapter 9 and verse 10, where he says this, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And then after Proverbs, you come to Ecclesiastes. I encourage you to read through Ecclesiastes in one sitting. Don't stop in the middle. It's depressing if you do that. Get to the end, because it's at the end of the book where you find the secret of Ecclesiastes. Where at the end of the book in chapter 12 and verse 13, he writes and he says, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. And right there we learn the secret of contentment. No matter what life throws at you, no matter what you go through, no matter how good or how bad it may be, what is my duty? To fear God and keep his commandments, and therein to be content. And then finally, you come to this book, the Song of Solomon. And it's in the Song of Solomon where I believe we find the secret of love. True love. Real love. A good example of that would be in Song of Solomon chapter 2 and verse 4. If you have a marker, just go ahead and stick it in this book. We're going to be here all week, okay? So just stick it in there, and we'll be back to this book time and time again. But in chapter 2, verse 4, he writes and he says, he brought me to the banqueting house, and his banner over me was love. So it's in this book that we find the secret to true love. True love. Real love. True love that endures the trials of life. True love that can stand the test of time. True love. A love that sent Christ to Calvary for me. John 3:16, probably one of the most well-known verses in all the Bible. Very simple verse. For God so loved the world that he gave. Why did Jesus do what he did? Because God so loved the world. I want you to notice in the title here, we read this in chapter 1 and verse 1, and it says simply the Song of Songs, which is Solomon. So you read that and you sat down and you thought, well, that was deep. That was good stuff. But it is good stuff. I hope you can wrap your mind around this, because this is not just a song. This is the Song of Songs. This is, in God's opinion, remember Solomon wrote this under inspiration of the Spirit of God, so this is not just Solomon's idea. It's not just Solomon's opinion. This is God's opinion, and that makes it not an opinion, that makes it fact. And God writes here, and he says, the Song of Songs. This is the chief song, the best song. There have been millions, probably billions, of love songs written. God says, this is the Song of Songs. This is number one. This is the best one. And this song is about a love between Solomon and a girl that's called, that we'll refer to as the Shulamite. I'll explain more about that in a moment. Solomon, according to 1 Kings chapter 4, Solomon wrote in his lifetime 3,000 proverbs, and he wrote 1,005 songs. I guess he got pretty good, because now he writes the Song of Songs, the greatest song ever written. What makes a song so great? Have you ever wondered what makes music so enjoyable? Because a song grabs your heart. It does something to your emotions. It pulls you. People say that, you know, music is all moral. It's not. Music communicates. And we know that. That's why, you know, I could take somebody, could take my wife, for example, and I could say to her, baby, I love you. And that means something to her. She likes it. She enjoys it. You know, she says, oh, thank you. Or I can look at her in my best singing voice, say, I love you. And she just melts. She's like putty in my... And guys know that. We know that. And that's why you get some dumb teenage guy that can't even play guitar. He'll take a guitar and he'll go out there and throw rocks against the window until his girl comes to the window, and hopefully he's got the right room. I always wondered what would happen if Dad showed up. And he's out there with a guitar and he'll play, the mic is not on. That's what he plays. Okay. Yeah. No. He goes, yeah, that was, thank you. They told me he had a sign. I thought, who told me they had a sign? I thought you was kidding. You were kidding. The mic is not on. Anyway, so he'll go out there and he'll play the song hoping that somehow, because he knows that music communicates and he wants to move her. This song is the song of songs. It goes deep. This is more deep than just the love between a man and a woman. This is a far greater song than just to talk about, you know, all that mushy stuff, if you've read through it, and you know, and you see some of that mushy stuff. It's deeper than that. Because this song paints a picture for us of the love that Christ has for His people and the love that His people are supposed to have for Him. This is deep. This is not just mush. You know, Hollywood's good at mush. That's not this. This is different. This is holy. This is God-given. This is right. Now, if you've ever read through the Song of Solomon, I know for years I read through it, you know, as a young Christian, I read through it and I could see things and it's like, man, that's good. I like this and I like that. But I couldn't really get it all together. I couldn't see how it all fits. I don't know if you ever had that problem, but I read it and I go, who is speaking here? One time a guy's speaking, next time a girl's speaking, then this group over here, these other ladies, whoever they are, they're speaking. It's hard to know who's speaking. Sometimes that can be confusing. Sometimes the guy's speaking. And then the girl's speaking. You go, well, what's going on here? How does this story fit together? So in my Bible college, one semester, the dean of the college, he taught a series on the Song of Solomon. He told a whole semester on this psalm. And I thought, oh, well, this will be great. My wife and I will take this course together because it's all about love. So we went together, and the first day, he blew me away. And I never looked at this book the same again. You see, it's not just about that warm, fuzzy feeling that you get, that you call love for your lady or your guy if you happen to be a lady. It's deeper than that. The key I found was, and he told me this. I didn't figure this out on my own. Somebody had to teach me because I'm dumb. And he taught me this, and he showed me this in culture. You see, back in those days when it was written, in culture, when royalty got married, it was a big deal. Really big deal. And they would be at least a week long, and maybe even longer, and every day they would do something special, and they'd devote each day to some special occasion. Well, on one of those days, they would take the bride and the groom, and they would stand them up there, and then they were before all the people, and then they would have to rehearse memories of their relationship. They would have to tell about this thing or that thing or the other thing in their relationship. Now, if you've ever had to tell a story all day, at some point you kind of run out of things to say. You don't know what to say next. And that's what that group of, I like to call them the choir. They weren't really a choir. But they would have a choir they had a script of certain questions that they would ask. And then they would ask a question of either the guy or the girl and get the discussion flowing again. And so that's why the book of Song of Solomon is kind of hard to put together, because it's really a gathering of memories of their relationship. But here's the thing. Once you get that key, you start moving the parts around and you kind of see the story unfold, and it is incredible. And so, this sermon is that story. And it's also the key for the rest of the week. So I hope you really get a grip on this, because this is really going to be helpful to you. In the Song of Solomon, the first thing that we meet, we come to chapter 1. And with this basic understanding, we meet this woman. And she's called the Shulamite girl. If you look in chapter 1, verses 5 and 6, it says, I am black but comely, O ye daughters of Jerusalem, as the tents of Kedar, as the curtains of Solomon. Look not upon me, because I am black, because a son hath looked upon me. My mother's children were angry with me. They made me the keeper of the vineyards, but my own vineyard have I not kept. So we meet this lady, and I'll just call her the Shulamite lady. I call her that because when you get to chapter 3 and verse 13,
We find in chapter 6 in verse 13, it says this. It says, "Return, return, O Shulamite." And she's called the Shulamite there. And so a lot of scholars say, oh, she's a Shulamite. So that means that she is from, everyone listen carefully, she's from Shunem. She's called the Shulamite because she's from Shunem. The first time I read that, I said, that's dumb. There's a big difference between Shulam and Shunem. So when I studied Hebrew, I learned a little bit of Hebrew. I started looking at the letters. And to spell Shunem, there's this little letter, it's called a nun. It's not that big. It's in the middle of the word, which means it's even smaller than what it would be at the end of the word. So it's just kind of small. But if you spell Shulam, then you've got something called a lamed, and it's big. It starts way up above the line and comes down to the line and goes over and down like that. And scholars used to have fun with that. They make the lamed and make turn it into a tree or draw little plants or stuff. They had a lot of fun. There's a big difference between those two words. And I said, well, she's not called a Shulamite because she's from Shunem. That doesn't fit. The words aren't related. So what is going on here? But again, when I took Hebrew, I figured it out. Shulamite. See, Hebrew is neat. Hebrew language. Does anybody here know Hebrew? Okay, in Hebrew, there's two kinds of ways of saying things. There's a masculine way and a feminine way. Words have masculine and feminine gender. Well, Shulamite is feminine. That's the feminine form of this word. Does anybody want to guess what the masculine form is? No? Okay, I'll tell you. Solomon. Solomon. She took the name of her bridegroom. Just like you and I, we're called Christians. We take the name of our Lord. We're called Christians because He's Christ. She took the name of Solomon and she's called the Shulamite. And you say, wow, that's good. It gets better. It gets so good. Because this woman, if you read in chapter 1, in verse 5 and 6, you find this lady. She's out there working in the field. Laboring in the field. And she describes herself here. She says, I am black but comely. Oh, ye daughters of Jerusalem. As the daughters of Jerusalem, that's the choir, right? As black as the tents of Kedar, as the curtains of Solomon. And she says this, look not upon me. Don't look at me because I'm black, because the sun hath looked upon me. She goes on to describe her family relationship a little bit later, which I'll get into in a minute. But she says she's been out in the fields, and she's been working in the fields, and the sun has burned her skin. And she describes herself that way as being black. Interestingly, she has a family. We learn in chapter 1, she's got a family. She's out in the vineyards working. And she says this about her family. She says her family, for some reason, they became angry with her. And so now she's out in the field. She's being treated more as a servant than as a child. And she's out there mistreated by her family, out there serving in the field. And she describes herself in this way as she's a broken woman. Working almost as a slave. Despised by her own family. If you read the scriptures, you'll find that in verse 6 it says that my mother's children were angry with me. So she's got her mother at least, and she's got some siblings there at least. But she's not treated as a member of the family. She's being mistreated, and she's sent out there to slave labor in the fields. That's where she is. And it kind of reminds me of the child of God. You and I, in our lost state, before we ever met Christ, we're out there in the fields of the world. Where the world and sin beat down upon us, and we were not much to look at. I don't know what kind of person you were before you got saved. I meet these people all the time, you know. They grow up in a Christian home. And thank God for that. That's a good thing. Christian parents should provide a good thing for your kids. But they grew up in a Christian home, and they share with me experiences I can't really relate to. You know, where they felt that their biggest sin in their life was talking back to their mom and dad. And I look at what I was as compared to that, and I go, wow, boy, if only that was my big one, you know. If only I didn't have some of the scars on my life that I have now. But folks, listen, I've been out there laboring in the field, and the sun and sin has been beaten down upon me. And to be honest with you, without Christ, well, I'm not much to look at. And neither are you. Without Christ, We're not much. This is her state. So she says this, don't look upon me. Don't look upon the outside. It's not very pleasing. I wouldn't want you to see what I look like. The toils of the field, the heat has robbed her of her beauty. And she says, don't look at me. Have you ever felt that way? You ever done something, maybe, child of God, if you've sinned throughout the day, I know we probably all do, but I mean, you've done something really dumb. And then you know you need to pray about it. You know you need to confess your sin. You want to go before the Lord, but you just don't want to really pray because you know. You feel so guilty and you almost just don't even want to talk to God about it. This is where she's at. And along comes the shepherd, Solomon. Now you're thinking, Solomon's a king. What's he doing out there keeping sheep? I don't know. It doesn't really tell us. But if you read Ecclesiastes chapter 1 and 2, he didn't just do shepherding. He also planted trees and made gardens. He did lots of things. This guy did lots of stuff. So I'm not amazed that he's out there keeping sheep. Maybe he just wanted to go out there and learn about sheep. I don't know. But he rides along out there and he meets this woman. He sees her. And look at verse 7 here, in chapter 1, verse 7. She says this to him. He's about to go away, and I'll get to that part of the story in a moment. But she says this, tell me, O thou whom my soul lovest, where thou feedest, where thou makest thy flock to rest at noon. You see, he comes to her, and he's a young shepherd, and he's seeking out pasture for his sheep when he gets there. And he meets this young lady there, the Shulamite girl, and immediately he's captivated by her. He falls in love with her. She's not much to look at, but there's something there that draws her to his heart. He falls in love with her. Now, in those days, they didn't have Facebook. They didn't have Twitter or Snapchat or any of those other things. If they wanted to remember what somebody looked like, do you know what they did? They would study their features, and they would relate their features to things around them in everyday life. And so we kind of had that, you know, they spend some time together, they get to know each other, and they describe one another in the book. And I love these descriptions in the book. If you look at Song of Solomon, chapter 4, turn over there, chapter 4, verses 1 through 7. And here we have a description. This is what he says of her. This is what he says about her. He says, behold, thou art fair, my love. Behold, thou art fair. Thou hast dove's eyes when thou within thy locks. Thy hair is as a flock of goats that appear from Mount Gilead. Thy teeth are like a flock of sheep that are even shorn, which came up from the washing, whereof everyone bare twins, and none is barren among them. Thy lips are like a thread of scarlet, and thy speech is comely. Thy temples are like a piece of pomegranate within thy locks. Thy neck is like the tower of David, builded for an armory, whereon there hang 1,000 bucklers, all shields of mighty men. Thy two breasts are like two young roes that are twins, which feed among the lilies. Until the day break and the shadow flee away, I will get me to the mountain of myrrh, to the hill of frankincense. Thou art fair, my love. There is no spot in thee. This is what he says about her. And ladies, I know you're greatly impressed, right? If your boyfriend or your husband looked at you and he started talking about like this, I mean, you would look at him and you would say, really? I mean, really? Goats? Doves? Are you serious with me? Sheep? Pomegranates? Get out of my sight. I don't want to hear that stuff. Nowadays we do it a little bit different. But in those days a woman would hear that and she'd say, oh. And that's the way they talked back then. Well, she describes him too. Turn over to chapter 5. Notice this in verses 10 through 16. Starting in verse 10, she's describing him here. She, in the book, she always refers to him as my beloved. That's one of the keys to understanding who's talking, okay? She refers to him as my love. He refers to her. She refers to him. Let me just say this again. Let me start again. If you look at the verse, she calls him my beloved. I'll get it straight in a minute. She calls him my beloved. He calls her my love. Got that out. Okay. Starting in verse 10. My beloved is white and ruddy, the chief among 10,000. His head is as the most fine gold. His locks are bushy and black as the raven. His eyes are as the eyes of doves by the rivers of waters, washed in milk and fitly set. His cheeks are as a bed of spices as sweet flowers. His lips like lilies dropping sweet smelling myrrh. His hands are as gold rings set with the beryl. His belly is as a bright ivory overlaid with sapphires. His legs are as pillars of marble set upon sockets of fine gold. His countenance is as Lebanon, excellent as the cedars. His mouth is most sweet. Yea, he is altogether lovely. This is my beloved, and this is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem. Now, guys, you have to admit, that sounds a whole lot better than sheep and goats. If you look at the two descriptions, this is what something that's always fascinated me. If you look at the two descriptions, the objects that she uses to describe him are of more value than the objects that describe her. I mean, she's sheep and goats and stuff, and he's all this other great stuff, beryl and, you know, all of that. And when you think about it, that's just like us. Christ, in his beauty, is far more valuable than we could ever think ourselves to be. He's much greater than we are. The beauty of Christ far surpasses anything that we could ever say about ourselves. Now, the time came when the shepherd has to go away. And by the way, this is all introduction. I haven't even got to the good stuff yet. Okay? The time comes that the shepherd has to go away, and he has to leave her. He doesn't want to leave, but apparently he needs to. Maybe he's got other kingly duties to do somewhere else. And so he tells her that he is going away, and she's heartbroken. She is filled with anxiety. And if you, ladies, you know, if your husband has ever had to go away for any amount of time at all, you know how that feels. And this is the way she feels. And so she says to him, go back to chapter 1 again. We read this earlier, but I really want you to grasp what's going on here. She says in chapter 1, in verse 7 and 8, she says this, "Tell me, O thou whom my soul loveth, where thou feedest, where thou makest thy flocks to rest at noon. For why should I be as one that turneth aside by the flocks of thy companions?" This is her question to him. Tell me where you're going. Tell me where you're going to be with the sheep. I want to know where you are. And here's his answer. Look at verse 8. "If thou know not, O thou fairest among women, go thy way forth by the footsteps of the flock and feed thyself and feed thy kids beside the shepherd's tents." Did you get what she said? If you want to find me, follow the footsteps of the sheep. Why? Because a sheep follows the shepherd, right? That's the way that works. That's why he's called a shepherd. He leads the sheep. So guess what? You are a sheep. And you're supposed to follow the shepherd. And if you don't, other people that are looking for the shepherd will not be able to find him because you won't be leading him the right way. And this gets better. This gets much better. You see, because in her heart, she wants no other shepherd. She doesn't desire anybody else in her life. She just wants him. That's all she wants. That's all she cares about. She doesn't say, "Where are you going? Tell me where you're going, because, you know, if you're leading me somewhere that I want to go, that I might enjoy, well, then I'll follow you." She doesn't say that. She doesn't say, "Tell me what it's like there. Is there, you know, nice green grass and plenty of good water? Is it comfortable there? Because if you lead me to a place of comfort, then maybe I'll follow you there." She doesn't care where he goes. She doesn't care what it's like. She just says, "I want to be with you. Tell me where you're going so I can be with you. Because no other shepherd will serve. No other shepherd will work in my life. It must be you." Now, Christian, a lot of us are just like that, you know. The Lord says, "I want you to do this, I want you to do that." We don't like it. We don't want to follow him there. That's not her heart. How's your love life? How's your walk with the Lord? How do you see the Lord? She wants no one else. What is your desire for Christ like? You know, I really believe that the reason why we do some of the dumb things that we do is because we just don't put the Lord number one in our life. We don't love him the way we should. I know this. I know that this world is filled with beautiful women. I know that. But I'm not going to go running off with any one of them. I'll give you two reasons why. Number one, because I love my wife and I would never do that to her. Number two, because she'd kill me. I got two good motivating factors to stay right there. If you love somebody, you want to please them. You don't want to hurt them. If you love the Lord, you just want him. You want to be with him. You want to walk with him. You want to talk with him all the time. The psalmist says this in Psalm 42. Turn over there. Psalm 42, verses 1 and 2. You know, I love this. I have a cup full of water on my pulpit. And I really love that. It's really helpful for me because I get dry mouth. But I heard a story about this guy that went to, he was preaching in a Presbyterian church. I probably shouldn't have been there, but he did. And there was a glass of water there, and he picked it up and he drank it, and everybody looked at him real funny. And he said, "What's wrong? What did I do wrong?" And they said, "You just drank the baptistry." Moving on. Where was I? Psalm 40, Psalm 42, and verses 1 and 2. Notice this. "As the hart panteth after the water brooks, so panteth my soul after thee, O God. My soul thirsteth for God, for the living God. When shall I come and appear before God?" This is what the psalmist says. We have a song in our songbook. I don't know if it's in yours or not. "As the deer panteth for the waters," or something like that. It comes from this psalm. It comes from this, right? And Christians all over the world stand to sing this song. And I wonder if we really mean it sometimes. Do we really thirst for God? Do we really hunger to be with Him? Because if we did, we wouldn't have any problems dragging ourselves out of bed in the morning to read our Bibles, because we want Him to speak to us. We wouldn't have any problem spending a little bit of time with the Lord in prayer, because we want to share our lives with Him. We wouldn't have so many struggles with sin, because we know sin separates us from God. And we want to be in fellowship with God, so let's get rid of sin so we can be in fellowship with God. But we don't love Him enough. And so there are so many other things that attract us in the world. This Shulamite woman, she says, tell me, where are you going? How can I be with you? Well, just follow the sheep. Do you long for the presence of the Lord? How's your love life? How's your walk with Him? So he leaves. We don't know how long he's gone. All we know is that she's described in the book as waiting and working and watching and hoping that someday he would return. And then one day it happens. Turn over to chapter 3. We have a description of this occasion, but in chapter 3, verses 6 through 11, she lifts up her eyes and she looks, and here's what it says. "Who is this that cometh out of the wilderness like pillars of smoke, perfume with myrrh and frankincense, with all powders of the merchant? Behold his bed, which is Solomon's. 80 valiant men are about it, of the valiant of Israel. They all hold swords, being expert in war. Every man hath a sword upon his thigh because of fear in the night. King Solomon made himself a chariot of the wood of Lebanon. He made the pillars thereof of silver, the bottom thereof of gold, the covering of it of purple, the midst thereof being paved with love for the daughters of Jerusalem. Go forth, O ye daughters of Zion, and behold King Solomon with the crown wherewith his mother crowned him in the day of his espousals and in the day of the gladness of his heart." One day, she's out there working in the fields, and she looked up and she sees this procession coming. And there's 60 soldiers out there around the bed, but the bed is empty. Now, the book doesn't describe this to us, but I imagine that it just came right up to where she was. And somebody in that procession went, "Young lady, get in the bed. This is for you. You're going home." And I imagine she said, "Wait a minute, I'm waiting for my shepherd lover. Where is he?" And then she looks up, and there he is, King Solomon. "Oh, it's you." Now, what we read here is a description not of that moment, which had to happen for this description to be true, but what we read here is a description of them riding into Jerusalem later. We know that because at the end of it, in verse 11, it says, "Go forth, O ye daughters of Zion, and behold King Solomon." They're riding into the city now, in all the pomp and circumstance, and she is there in that bed, riding into the city, and the challenge goes forth. She's been out in the fields working, but the time has come, and he comes, and he takes her home. He's not a shepherd anymore. When he came the first time, he was a shepherd. Are y'all getting this? When he comes the second time, he's going to be king. He comes and he takes her home. And he takes her in. They go into Jerusalem there. And I imagine he takes her to the palace. And he goes in. And there'll be more about that later on this week. I don't have time for all of this today. They go in and she walks into the banqueting room there, and I imagine there's a, you know, in my mind, you know, Jim's imagination, there's a long table there. And there's places set for everybody to sit, and there's one chair there, and she knows it's hers because it's marked. The banner over me is love. And she knows that that's her spot because she knows that he doesn't love anybody else. He only loves her. And she loves him. The king that had come to woo her love as a shepherd returned as a king. And she's gone away with him. He'd not forgotten her. He kept his promise. He said, I'm going away, but I'm going to come again. And he did. And he took her home. Now, here's the message. That was all introduction. Isn't that great? Here's a message. You're saying, well, how you can do that? You only got five. What did you say this morning? You only got 2 minutes, brother. I don't know. But we can't eat lunch until I'm done, so hang on. All right? And I wish, I really do, I wish I had more time to share this amazing story. And throughout the week, I'm going to share some things from the story to you. How the bride, she returns to her home with the king, and she enjoys a communion with him with the, you know, on the mountain of spices that's described in the book. It's a picture of our communion with the Lord. It's beautiful. If you don't know the book, get into the book, read the book, study the book, fall in love with Jesus, because he surely loves you. You see the Shulamite lady here who has been blackened by sin, and he gave her a veil and she's covered up now, and they come into the city and she rides in with him, not blackened by sin anymore, but covered in honor and humility. They come into the city. And when I read that, I'm amazed every time that Christ sees something in me. I don't know what it is, because when I look at me, I don't like me. Sometimes I wonder what my wife ever saw in me. Now I know. I'm handsome. But I wonder sometimes, really, as far as character is concerned, why would God love us? But he does. He sees something in me. I don't understand it, but he does. And Christ is the shepherd king. He doesn't cease to be king. When he comes, he's going to take me away. The king of glory is going to come again. And maybe I'll understand it then, but right now I'm still amazed. I'm amazed. I'm amazed that in Romans chapter 5 and verse 8, the Bible tells us that God commended his love toward us, and that while we were yet sinners, do you get that? While you were at your absolute worst, when you rejected him and you hated him, he loved you. If you're here today without Christ, you keep that in mind. You're going to go to hell in the face of God's love for you. That's not his desire for you. That's not what he wants. Christ is our king. Remember when Jesus was about to leave? He was talking to his disciples. In John chapter 13, I don't have time to turn there, but John chapter 13, he says, I'm going away. And you can't follow me yet. I'm going to leave, but you can't follow me yet. His disciples are distraught. They're filled with anxiety, kind of like the Shulamite woman was when he said, I'm leaving. They said, Lord, where are you going? He says, don't worry, I'm going to come again. And then you get to chapter 14, and he begins to really get into depth and explain that. And he explains to them that he's going to go away, but he's going to come again. And he says this. He says, if it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you, and I will come again and receive you unto myself, that where I am, there you may be also. And whither I go, you know. And the way, you know. They were all confused. We don't know the way. How are we going to know the way? One of the disciples actually opened his mouth and showed his intellect. He said, Lord, we have no idea where you're going. How can we know the way? And I just imagine Jesus going, man, did I choose the wrong 12 guys? These guys are dumber than a box of rocks. He looks at him and he says, have I been so long time with you? Yet hast thou not known me, Philip? I am the way! That's what Jesus said. I'm the way. I'm the truth. I'm the life. No man cometh unto the Father but by me. Jesus has made us some promises, folks. He has gone away. But he's coming again. He's promised he's going to come again. In the meantime, what are we supposed to be doing? We're supposed to be watching. And we're supposed to be working. And we're supposed to keep that love alive. Remember what Jesus says in Revelation chapter 2? He's talking to a church that was a good church, right? The church of Ephesus. They had all the doctrine straight. And they, you know, all the guys carried King James Bibles and all the ladies wore dresses and that kind of thing. And everything was right about the church. Except for one thing. Jesus says this, "Nevertheless, I have somewhat against thee because thou hast left thy first love." Oh yeah. They look like good Christians. They walk like good Christians. They carry Bibles like good Christians. They probably went on evangelistic tours with the leaders, and they probably did witnessing and door knocking and all of that stuff, and everything looked like it was just right. But in their hearts, it wasn't right. And Jesus looked right in and he said, "I've got a problem with you. You don't love me like you used to." How about it, Christian? How's your love for the Lord? I remember the day I got saved. I was sharing my testimony for Sunday school. If you missed it, you should have been in Sunday school. Every time God's house is open, you should be here. All right? Except for, you know, like when we're not having services and I'm walking around in my stocking feet in the parsonage. Don't do that. Anyway, anytime the doors are open, you should be here. But this morning I was sharing some things about my testimony. And I remember the day that I was walking up the road alone in the bomb dump. And a bomb dump's a good place to get saved. You can either get saved or, you know, you die, I guess. So I'm walking up the road. I am broken with my sin. I am heavy. I am burdened down. And I prayed the sinner's prayer. And I didn't get it from a book. And it wasn't fancy. It wasn't flowery. Because God looks at the heart. And this is what I said. I said, "Lord, I really, really, really messed up my life. And I know that I have offended you. And I want you to forgive me and do something with me because I can't." That was my sinner's prayer. In my heart, I was telling God, "I'm sick of my sin. Please, can you cleanse me and make me your child?" And he did. A couple of weeks go by, and I started worrying about that. I said, "You know, I wasn't in church. There was no preacher there. I don't know if I said the right words. I don't know what to do." So I went to Ron, the guy that led me to the Lord. I said, "I'm not sure I'm saved. I'm not sure I did it right." He said, what do you think you have to do?" I said, "Well, I don't know. I guess there's probably some formula, something you have to say, or, you know, I don't know, Hail Marys and or something. I don't know." He goes, "You don't have to do anything. All you got to do is trust Jesus and ask Him to forgive you. Did you do that?" "Yes, I did that." He said, "Well, then take Him at His word. Believe the promise." I challenge you this morning. Take Him at His word. Believe the promise. He's coming again, Christian. Wait, work, and love Him. Let's all stand, every head bowed.